The following message is provided through the teaching ministry of Journey Baptist Church in Silver Springs, Texas. It is our desire that by listening, you will be encouraged to trust Jesus for all, treasure Jesus above all, and to take Jesus to all.
Who have we focused primarily on? David, right? We did probably the longest unit of that last book we just finished was on the life of David. Okay? And so interestingly, here we are kind of on the back end of that. We get to one of the writings of David where he sort of gives this typified statement. What I mean by that is he typified his life, saying the entire reason that I exist in my own mind, my heart of hearts, is this. It's embodied in large part in this one psalm. It's all throughout his writings. It's in Psalm 73, it's in Psalm 37, it's all throughout, but this one hits at it very pointedly. So I found that very interesting, that we have had a pretty long running start into who David was, things he did right, and especially in lieu, again, if you've been in Sunday school the last month or so, what his son Solomon did wrong in a lot of ways. Not that David was perfect, but I think those are two big, big reasons that those two men's lives were contrasted against each other in Scripture, is that David had this heart after God. So we are going to explore that really deeper, what that actually means for us individually and as a corporate body. So that's going to start tonight. But first, let's go to the psalm again to keep it fresh on our minds. So Psalm 27, I'm going to read all 14 verses. Psalm 27, this is of David, a psalm of David, says, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war arise against me, yet I will be confident. One thing have I asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock, and now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me. And I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud, and be gracious to me, and answer me. You have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, do I seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger. O you who have been my help, cast me not off and forsake me not, O God of my salvation. For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. Give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me. They breathe out violence. I believe that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord, be strong, and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord." Okay. Kyle, do they have the questions? Kyle's going to pass out. We're going to do two questions tonight, okay? One we're going to do right up front. Go ahead and get it out of the way. I want you to really think before you start writing anything down, okay? Really think about this. Think about scan your whole life. Maybe this just past week might be helpful for starters, okay? When you read this question, No one's going to read this other than you. This is just for you to have in front of you during this session. And I'm actually going to, we'll get to that later. You're going to have it in front of you this session. So I want you to write something that as you hear me talk or Kyle interject or anyone else for that matter that has interjections and add to's, I want you to have this question in front of you. It's the same question David wrestled with in this psalm. Okay? I know some of you don't have it yet, but the question is this. What is the one thing that hinders you most from beholding the beauty of God? And I might even add the word daily. Daily. Think about your daily life. What's the one thing that hinders you most? I've got some examples there to kind of help kickstart if you're not quite sure what we mean by thing. It's a very ambiguous word sometimes. No time, emotional apathy. You just don't feel like you love the Lord right now. Don't want to spend time. Too busy. Lack of accountability with others. Things like that. I'll give just another minute or two or three, as long as I see pens working, really. Take your time. Again, don't feel like you have to share this. This is not going to be turned in. This is not homework. Although we should ask this question every day. If you haven't thought of anything, you have plenty of time to think of something before the evening's out. I'm going to go ahead and continue on. Okay, so hopefully we're all at least thinking, if not have one somewhat nailed down as to what that one thing in our life might be keeping us from having, I would even say, a heart like David's. Not the heart of David's, because we're not David, nor are we called to be, none of us. Except maybe you, David, I didn't think about that. The other David. David's excluded. We're not called to have the heart of someone else. We have uniqueness to us. But there is something about what David did and what his pursuits were that made him very special. Okay? So we're going to explore that tonight. Now, the why of what we're doing. I want to, before we get into the notepad over here, and this is basically, I'll go ahead and explain this briefly. This is a brainstorming session that Cal and I did in preparation for this whole month, really. So this is just for your reference. I'm going to be referencing this a lot. Maybe, I don't even know if I'll write anything on the new one over here, but I've got it just in case. We'll see what happens. But I am going to be referencing some of these things here. So for your own interest, you can kind of see all the jots and tittles, so to speak, as to how our weird brains have worked through all the processes that we're trying to discover. But the why of it is very simple. Guys, don't get lost in the methodology and the structure and the tree diagram and all of that stuff, because the why is what's important. Why we're doing anything like this, why we're even meeting here at all, should be because we all want the same one thing, right? If we're going to be a body, as Paul challenged churches all throughout his letters, he was always pursuing this concept of unity. Right? Ephesians, Romans, Corinthians, it's everywhere. Anytime he would preach the gospel through those pages, he would preach the gospel, he'd go all the way back to the Old Testament, and he would preach it and preach it and preach it. And then immediately on the heels of that, I think of Romans 12 and Ephesians 4, two wonderful examples. Immediately after preaching the gospel in the fullest way he could, guess where he would start with his exhortation, telling a church, different churches, but all the same message. He was saying, pursue unity in the Spirit, in the bond of peace. You have these commissions, so to speak, to not just be doing your own thing, but to be pursuing this one something together. And I believe that something could be summed up in a lot of different ways. One word, you could say love. Jesus would say what? The whole command of God is summed up in what? Love God, the Lord your God, with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. So Jesus, he summed it up once that way. Another way, when he's talking to his disciples, he summed it up a little bit different. He said, I've given you a new command. It's really not a new command, John 15 through 17, but it is a new command. Love one another as I've loved you. Sounds kind of similar, doesn't it? So you've got these common themes throughout the New Testament that are all, again, drawing upon Old Testament doctrine that's tying the entire human existence together. There is this one thing coming out of it all. okay? This one thing that people are to be pursuing. And so if we miss that, everything else is a house of cards. That's what we're proposing that we don't do, that we don't as a church collectively, let alone individually, but collectively, that we don't miss the one thing together. Okay, does that make sense? So we're trying to get at that. And then once we establish what that is, how do we get there? And this explains a lot of the how, not the why and the what so much. So the why and the what, I think a lot of it can be found in Psalm 27, particularly verse 4. Let's look at that verse again. Here's that summation statement that David says. He says, "One thing have I asked of the Lord." Again, I don't mean to only pick on those who've been in Sunday school, but does that sound a little reminiscent of a recent story? With a son of David's who became king, "One thing have I asked of the Lord." What did Solomon ask for? I found that very interesting. In fact, that hit me when Kyle was preaching on that particular verse this last Sunday. I thought, wow, how incredible that God came to Solomon and said, "Ask of me," same language, "ask of me what you want, and I will give it to you." And so as we explored through 4 weeks of Solomon's life in Sunday school over the last month and I, we've noticed that Solomon was given this wisdom. It was a good thing. Like God gave it. He blessed it. He blessed Solomon over and abundant. But it was that very blessing of God, that thing that was a catalyst in the end to turn his heart to love for him, create this checklist of sinful things to do against God. His heart just turned on him. Big time. I mean, it was so blatantly sinful that all the sins Solomon fell to, we discovered this. This blew me away. I never heard this preached about Solomon or taught. That there was this checklist almost, that if you go back to Deuteronomy and see what God had commanded his kings to do, people who were leaders, Solomon almost used that, it seems, as a checklist of things to do. So in the wisdom he was given, being made the wisest man on the planet who would ever exist before, who had ever existed, who would ever exist, God's words, not man's words, God's words, in that wisdom, he falls prey to checking off all of the possible sins that he could as king. It was astounding. It was an astounding discovery, especially whenever you read, let me see if we can find it. If you have your Bibles, I don't have it written down, so I'm hoping I can find it quick. Especially when you read, yep, here it is, 1 Kings 11. Especially when you see what God says to Solomon when he essentially is taking away his kingship. Go to 1 Kings chapter 11. So I got very curious at that really, I think it might have been that last week or two that Matt and I were kind of walking through teaching on Solomon. I got real curious, like, okay, that's kind of hard to understand. And again, we're going to move away from this and get to this in a minute. But this was so fundamental in helping me understand. I hope it does something similar for you. Look at what God says to Solomon, and look who he brings in, and look at the language that's used in light of Psalm 27, okay? Let's just read from verse 1. We'll read the first couple verses here. "Now King Solomon," this is later in his life, in his sin, it says, "he loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations, concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, 'You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you. For surely,'" here's the language I want you to pay attention to. This is God's word. "For surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon, however, clung to these women in love. He had 700 wives," everybody guffaws, "who were princesses, and 300 concubines," again, "and his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not wholly true to the Lord, his God, as was the heart of David, his father." For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites, and so on and so on. Find it very interesting. David sinned big time as well, did he not? We discovered that. In fact, we often, I think, tend to elevate the badness of David's sin even more than Solomon's, at least in my history of Sunday school experiences. It's like, David, whoa, murder, treachery, deceit, cover up. I mean, it's stuff TV shows are made of these days. Solomon, 1,000 women. He was just kind of the quirky weirdo. But do you see it? You see, it's very interesting how God's word puts these two men's what? Their hearts. Y'all see that? Not practice. Not even necessarily theology. Don't misunderstand that. But the issue, as God has taken us from the beginning, and I think all the way to the end, there's this common thread that it's the heart that pulls people after other gods. Or it's the heart that says, Psalm 73, David says, there's nothing on earth that I desire besides you. Whom have I in heaven but you? God alone, right? Even in his sinful practices that happened at times, his heart remained with God. So, what must be our one thing as a church body? I truly believe that we have to have a collective heart. A heart after God. It's that simple. It's not practice. Practice is a part of it. Practice is a manifestation. We've heard this a million times over. And really, all I'm going to do tonight, guys, spoiler alert for everybody, I'm really just going to try to fill 40 minutes of rephrasing the same things over and over and over. Because repetition will hopefully make it stick for all of us. Any teachers in the house? Yes. That's the way to do it. To make people remember something, you rephrase it. And then you put it in a story. And then if you're Jesus and really good, you use parables. I don't think I can do that on the spot like he did. But we're just going to reword everything, looking at different scriptures, pulling them in. And I think we're going to see that scripture is doing just that. It's using stories of sinful men and sinful women to rephrase and constantly rework the same thread over and over and over so that eventually, every time we go to it, we see it. I think that's what Scripture is doing on a much more grandiose, mountain view looking down level. If we could step back and see it all together, see the forest for the trees, so to speak, that we would see that, wow, it is like what Jesus summed it up as. It is, every bit of it. Every bit of it. Okay, so there's the why. Why are we doing this? Why is there even the ideas of restructuring anything if things seem... Well, it's because sometimes the motivation for the why or the what, the purpose, the end goal, sometimes you get revelation of how you can get there more efficiently, maybe even quicker. If you've got a treasure, if you realize that that field across the road had buried treasure under it, would you not be mobilized to go and to go quickly to buy it? We wouldn't just be kind of floundering business as usual, right? If we found one thing, maybe just one thing on this page that could get us there quicker, we should want that. Shouldn't we? It only makes sense. If Christ is a treasure, if he is a treasure, then the smallest strategy, any way that could get us mobile, get our hearts in line better than it was yesterday, better this year than it was last year, we ought to at least be open to that. So I want y'all to hear my heart. I want you to hear Kyle's heart. I believe they're in accord here that we're not at all trying to just promote structure for structure's sake or methods for method's sake or strategy for strategy's sake. This in any idea like this is all so that we can be mobilized to just see God. Don't you just want to see God every day? I mean, see him, talk with him, not at him. I feel like I talk at God way more than I talk with God. I want to talk with God. I want to meet with God. I want to go across the room of my house and see God. Be with God. Just like you go see your neighbor down the street, I want to go across the house and see God. Or on the front porch, or in the break room at work. I want to go see God. Okay, I think that's enough on the why. So, the structure. What are the means? What are the ideas as of now? Again, this is our weird brain's way. This is really my writing, as Kyle was kind of throwing ideas. This is kind of what we've just threw down. I thought it'd be interesting just for you to be able to see. Josh, I even have your name in there somewhere. You're part of an example, so you got on the page. But here's what we're doing. Okay, we said, who's our model? Who's our model? Who are we following? We're following Christ. So should it not be as simple, at least at the bare bones of it all, to say Jesus had to have some sort of strategy, some sort of idea himself, being a man, being fully wise. He had to have some sort of strategy when he went out, when he came of age, maybe in his 20s, early teens, late teens, maybe even as that boy in the temple, 11 years old, all throughout. He had to have some sort of concept of strategy of, okay, maybe a certain number of people would be good. What do you think about that, Father? 12? Sounds good to me. I don't believe it was ambiguous. I think there was strategy to everything Jesus did. Because Jesus said everything he did, he only did because he saw the Father doing. He had this constant flow of communication with God. And so I believe that has to trickle down into every facet of his life to really make sense. For him to be fully walking in the Spirit of God in everything he did, I think he had strategy everywhere. Okay? So that brought us to this. What did Jesus actually do? Who was he with? Who did he meet with regularly? In other words, I wanted to answer the question. Kyle wanted to answer the question. I think we would probably all be very interested if together we could discover what did Jesus have in place to keep him holy? You ever thought about that? Well, other than God, yes, but just think about that question. Think about means, things to an end. Don't we say that this helps in our sanctification, right? It's a means to something. This is not holiness. Staring at this all day will not make you holy. It leads you to the Holy One, who will then do a work in your heart to make you holy. So I believe Jesus also, he had some sense of structure around him, the people he was with, the things he did, his practices, his mannerisms, his habits. There were things he did regularly that aided him in walking with God in a fullness we won't experience this side of heaven. But he did it. And I believe he was not so far removed from where we are trying to figure it out. So that's where I think it kind of gets very exciting. Because then we start to, I think, in one, I don't like to say close the gap because he's infinitely greater than us, but he was man. And Hebrews would tell us that he understands and sympathizes with our weaknesses. Because he's been tempted in every way. He's walked through tiredness, dehydration, all of those things. And so in one sense, this kind of, I think, closes the gap for us to realize that, you know what? Christ might actually have some solutions to these problems. Maybe your one thing problems, my one thing problem. Maybe Christ had some structure, Jesus Christ himself. Maybe he has something to say, something to offer me as help to overcome my one thing that might not be God at this moment. So, Jesus got by himself. Kyle has talked, how many years do you think you've talked on Primed now? Oh, is that it? I thought that went way further back. I guess I was thinking of the Gospel Primer. It doesn't go all the way back to when that started. Okay. Well, Primed, if you've been in Journey, any time within the last 2 years, you've probably heard Kyle preach and teach on this quite a bit. This whole concept of taking this, what do you call that? Acronym? All right. Taking this acronym into your Bible reading every single day. P stands for you wake up in the morning or at night, whenever you look at this piece of calf skin with pages in between. and you do, and you're about to do something with it. Hopefully not throw it against the wall. You're about to do something with it, though. First thing you do, this helps you, this helps guide you through handling this properly. Okay? You pray before you read. God, give me eyes to see you. Eyes to see, gaze upon your beauty, right? Then you read. You actually go through and you actually have to do the task of reading, which some of you, I understand, don't like to do that. I hated reading until I was 18 years old. My favorite activity now. But I know some of you hate it. It's hard for you to read anything, let alone the Bible. I get it. That's tough. But it has to be done. It's something that's part of the means. I was identify a truth. So as you read, even if you only read one verse, you're identifying a very simple, very succinct truth about who God is. Okay? Not too difficult. Depends on what book you're in sometimes, how difficult that becomes. Okay? You've got the M for meditate, and you're going to be meditating on that truth throughout the day. E, entreat. Somebody explain entreat to me. What does that word mean? Entreat the favor of the Lord. Ground much better. So you're entreating the favor of God to say, come in and do that out of me. Let others see that truth in practice. Sounds like Jesus, doesn't it? What was the D? The D was added after y'all worked on Prime for a while, my understanding. D is to declare. You're taking that truth that kind of happens in that middle point there, whatever you identified. You're declaring that to whomever you're around all day. If you're a stay-at-home mom, it might just be your kids or your husband when he gets home later. Okay, it might be your coworkers who you're around all day. It might be your students who you're around all day or your coworkers there. It could, whoever you're around, seeking, declaring this, okay? So we saw this, not these letters. That's not in the Bible. But we saw this principle in the life of Jesus. Okay, John tells us that if we wrote everything about Jesus' life, there's no way. And I don't know if y'all, but I've sometimes made the mistake of thinking, well, that was only in there twice. Like, there's only a couple accounts of Jesus going by himself. Did he really do it every day? Well, again, if they wrote about every day of his life going by himself, that's all I would ever read about. And I would never get the stories of Lazarus being raised from the dead. So then I put myself in perspective. Like, just because, you get what I'm saying. But nonetheless, the practice is there. And Jesus modeled for the disciples this concept of stepping away. Stepping away from the people, the crowds, even his closest friends. Jesus probably enjoyed hanging around those guys. I mean, he loved those guys to death. In a way, we think we're close with our best friends. I can't imagine how Jesus actually felt for Peter and John, the one whom he loved, his best friend. Can you imagine the love of the God-man for another man? Unparalleled. Unparalleled. And yet still, who was more important? He would step away and he would say, guys, I'm going over here to pray. And he would seek the Lord alone. Okay? So a lot of y'all are probably pretty familiar with a lot of the passages where Jesus does that. But even before Jesus, there's this concept of... So I got a couple notes I want to touch on. What struck me with the primed is... Do y'all walk out of your house in the morning and you just feel empty-handed? I remember when I was a teacher... Wasn't a teacher very long. But I was a teacher long enough to realize that almost every day I went to work, I feel like I'd forgotten something. It was so crazy in the morning. My mind was in 5 million places, teachers probably and coaches, people who have real busy jobs, and they're not the only ones. I remember being a teacher, and that was one of my struggles. I would get to work 40 minutes after I'd woken up and felt like I'd forgotten 10 things. You know, you just kind of walk out feeling like the old adage, you don't have your pants on. That kind of feeling, that it's almost scary. Like I'm crossing a street right now and I feel this way. This is bad. But this whole concept, I feel that way spiritually way too often. I'm walking out of my house and I'm empty-handed. I'm just being completely transparent with you guys tonight. And I hope y'all can be transparent with yourselves. If you feel empty-handed spiritually, like you have nothing to give, then we don't need to worry about this yet. We have to get alone with God and be filled. Because the smaller structures, the meeting with two or three brothers together, will not have its fulfillment if you've not been filling yourself with God and not been seeing God regularly. You won't have anything to give your brother, let alone a lost person. You will feel empty-handed, like I do oftentimes at work lately. I have not been rigorous in this. I have not been disciplined in this, like I have in the past. And what's interesting about the past is it's always 2020, isn't it? Hindsight is always 2020. And I can look back at 9 years ago, when I was devouring the Word of God hours a day, every break I had, either between college classes or between college classes and work, if it was a 30-minute gap or a 2-hour gap, I promise you, I had my Bible on hand. I just did. Now, I can't confidently say that anymore because I don't take this to work anymore. Maybe I should. Because I can look back at the fruit, and hindsight being 2020, I can say, I was sharing the gospel a lot more regularly with people. And it was in a harder context there. But what was the big difference? I'm convinced that it happened here first. I started over the years maybe getting busy, having other one things, to reference what's on your paper there, having other one things. Family grows, job grows, responsibilities grow, now you have a house, whatever it is. Those things slowly... That sounds like one of the four soils, doesn't it? Slowly, things start to eat away, fall by the wayside. I'm just speaking about me. So I love this idea. It hit me hard whenever I wrote this down, because this is how I feel a lot of times in terms of alone time with the Lord. I feel like I'm leaving empty-handed. The whole concept of manna came up, and I'm not going to talk about a lot of this in as much detail as I'm probably actually going to. I'm not planning on it, because Kyle, we're going to be kind of dissecting each one of these through the next couple weeks. But just to touch on a couple of the big ideas. Manna. Primed is the manna principle. If y'all have never heard of that, that was a book written, was it not? The manna principle is just the principle you see how God provided for the people of Israel in the wilderness. A lot of us have heard that story, but it really is, the details of the story are fascinating. The whole concept of not leaning on yesterday's manna, because it's gone, and not preparing for tomorrow's manna, because God's not going to provide that yet. If you do, what did God do to the manna? Worms. Anybody want to eat worms? Now, physically, no. But again, if I'm honest, I've been totally fine a lot of times eating worms spiritually, because I'm resting on last year's manna. Well, I studied that last year pretty thoroughly, so I think I'm pretty good. God says, that's not gazing. You're not seeing my beauty. You're not being drawn in to my temple like David was pressing in. Like, press in deeper. There is treasure to be found there. Okay? So this is prime. This is where we see the crux of everything trickling down from. Getting every individual healthy. If every individual in a group or a body, common analogy for the church, is it not, is it's a body. Okay? And then Paul would later define that by even using things like fingers and ears. Use feet, I forget, hands. He actually uses the physical body to describe this relationship between an individual member, which is where we get the whole one of the concepts of church membership, members as they relate to the whole. The health of one member and how that health relates to the health of the whole. But we cannot expect to have this unity if we're not here first. Okay, so this is number one. Now, I want you to focus on this arrow, because this is probably going to be the biggest change, I would think. Kyle may kind of usurp that and change the way that's said tomorrow or tonight. Feel free, Kyle. But I think this arrow right here, I want you to focus on this. This is what took, and really this one too. This is what took a lot of our attention when we were brainstorming, because I just want to let you in into my mind. It's not too scary there. I compartmentalize. I'm a very analytical thinker. I try to compartmentalize everything and try to analyze every individual component as much as I can down to the grassroots, and then go here and then go here. And once I've analyzed every component, take it all together, and I feel like I've accomplished or conquered the world. Far from true, but that's the way I feel. And I do that with church. I noticed it when we started putting this on paper, that it's so easy for me to put all of the activities of church into these different compartments as if they're not related. Does that make sense? I'm going to say that again. It's as if in my heart and in my mind, really, it starts in my mind. I didn't realize this until I wrote this down on the piece of paper. When I drew that arrow and then that other arrow from DNA back to primed, and I'll explain in a minute, I realized that in my mind, I was seeing Sunday school over here in a box, and I was seeing corporate worship and preaching kind of here in a box, and then gospel community meetings on Wednesdays was over here in its box, and then DNA groups was kind of a thing of the past that we kind of maybe feel we should be doing, but it's got its place kind of off in the wilderness. And then primed is that thing that we all know we should be doing, but we struggle with so much. And then I got to thinking, why are there boxes? That's not the way a body works. A body is constantly in relationship. All the individual parts are in constant communication with one another all the time. So if you get to the biblical roots of it, the church ought to be functioning, I believe, the same way. And so that started opening up some doors, I think, and maybe, you know, some conversation of saying, okay, what do we do? First, the DNA. We've talked about that before. At first, it was stood for another acronym, Discover, Nurture, and Accountability. This, now I wasn't here when all this was formed, so I could be speaking out of turn a little bit, but in my understanding, DNA groups were just groups of two or three like gender sectors of believers, bad word, groups of believers who are coming, I don't know where that came from. I told you it's not too scary in there, but it does get muddy. Two or three like-gendered groups of Christians coming together for the sake of, like, deeper fellowship, right? Kind of familiar. Even if you've never heard DNA, that concept makes sense. Well, again, Jesus' life. He had a core group of people who, for reasons that aren't explained to us in Scripture, he would take into the mother-in-law's house and perform a healing. And everybody else had to stay outside. How do you think those guys felt? Maybe that's why Thomas in the end was like, I'm not going to believe a thing. Because I'm always being left outside. Isn't it interesting? But on the way up here, actually I was on the way home from work, I was thinking, this makes sense to us. We don't get upset by the fact that our children have best friends. This is as real as anything in our reality we've ever known. It shouldn't be unexpected for Jesus to have quote-unquote best friends. There seems, even in the God-man, to be this hierarchy of relationship that I believe was necessary for sanctification, was necessary for the proper components to work and function properly. In other words, if one individual is going to become the rock of the church, I think he needed to have a little bit of special relationship with Jesus. And I think Jesus knew that. I think Jesus knew that. And I think Jesus was conscious of it. I don't think these were just ambiguous things floating around that just happened, like the Big Bang Theory. Jesus was intentional, I believe, about spending more time with three people on a different level. That doesn't make everybody else less important. We don't know if they felt that way or not. Maybe they did. But again, that shouldn't hit us as a hard reality because we do it all the time. Don't we all have best friends? And some of us do get offended when we're not the best friend of that other person. But the reality is, you have a best friend too. And no one else is offended. That's your best friend. It's just the way relationships work. There's not a complete balance in this thing called relationships. And I think that's a God-designed thing. So that led us to, should DNA groups be a part of the church? Well, it was a part of Jesus' life and ministry, so I think so. Maybe. In fact, it's interesting because Kyle told me, he said, Danny, didn't you say Danny Caldwell at the Riley Springs? He's kind of getting back on that. And did you want to share anything about that? Like, have y'all had conversations about that? Or? As he mentioned, seeing that in Scripture specifically, like drawn, or just that's where he feels. Okay. Well, I thought that was interesting because when Kyle and I started discovering this, he just brought to light after the fact that, well, that's interesting because Danny seems to be leading Riley Springs in the same direction. So it's kind of exciting to know that you're kind of not alone in some of the strategies that are in place. But again, we're seeing this in Jesus' life. I want to talk about this one verse because I thought this verse was fascinating. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. I haven't done as much study as I would have liked to on this, so I hope, Lord forgive me if I'm at all taking this out of context, but someone help me out. Where is Ecclesiastes? Oh, jeez. Kyle, why'd you let me up here? Past Proverbs. All right. Ecclesiastes 4:12. Let's see. All right, let's try to get a little running start context here so I don't take it completely out of context. Let's back up to verse 9. Chapter 4, verse 9. Two people, here we go, in light of DNA, two people are better than one. Because they have a good reward for their toil. Toil, interesting word. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, and has not another to lift him up. I think we might be doing good in context here. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. I think we're doing maybe better than I thought in context here. So this whole concept of a man being alone in his toil, isn't it toil to fight to see God? It's toilsome work. It's not easy. I'm not saying this is easy. I think this is where the fight is. This is the army. These are the foot soldiers here. Once you get to here, you're calling on the Calvary. You're able to call on people here. The real battle is here. So again, the compartments, the walls of my compartments came crashing down when I realized I can't do this apart from this. In other words, what happens in Ecclesiastes 4? What happens whenever you have two or three together as opposed to one? Their strength. Right? Strength is described in this. It can't be broken. There's another word that I love, intimacy. That's not in there. But notice how it says, how can one keep warm? But if two are there, they can lie next to each other. Very intimate language there. I believe that's teaching a principle that when two or three brothers or sisters are together in fighting to see God, to put it in the big new covenant picture that we can now see, that mountaintop view, when two or three brothers or sisters are fighting to see God together, strength and intimacy. More so than when you're alone. Now that doesn't mean you can't have extreme intimacy alone, but it's going to be a hard battle. So the compartments, the D, you probably can't see back there, but the D, instead of discover, we change it to declare. We're basically going to be roping these two together. You see how that is? So as you end, if you think of it linearly, like this way my mind works, that's why I drew it this way. D in primed means to be declaring this truth you've identified that morning. That's it. And the truth might be, God is strong. That might be it. Three words. You're going to be focused on declaring that truth. But here's the thing. You're going to have two or three brother, well, I guess one or two brothers or sisters alongside you, texting, calling, in your meetings, when, however regularly that is, and we'll talk about that later. You're going to have that set amount, that Peter, James, and John group, to say, are you declaring? What was your truth? Let me tell you my truth. Let me tell you what my truth is. That might be how you start the conversation. Just text one or two in your group and tell them what your truth is. That's your first declare. Call them before you go to work and give them your truth. Hey, just reminded you, my truth this morning, I'm meditating on it all day. God is strong. God comforts me. Whatever the truth is. But roping that into the DNA, now all of a sudden, I think creates this strength in numbers that before it was very easy for us to say, well, if I'm not doing my reading in the morning, so what? I mean, honestly, does that go through anybody else's mind? So what? I don't have a so what if David is calling me the next day. Hey, how'd you do yesterday? You know, I got the chance to share with a coworker. You know, or Kyle's texting me saying, hey, here's my truth. Isn't that going to spur me on? Even if I forgot to read that morning, I'm probably going to do something to make time later in the morning to get a truth from God and not leave the rest of the day empty-handed. So there's going to be this strength coming, this accountability, declaring what you discovered, nurturing each other. So there's going to be this intimacy of just asking each other, hey, what can we be doing for each other, helping each other? What are you struggling with? Those kinds of questions. And accountability. Accountability is that ugly word that no one likes. But accountability is how we get over these so what motives in our life. The so what's that dominate our failures here. We have to get better at this, guys. We have to. I'm speaking solely to myself because I don't know anybody out there. I don't know your hearts. I can know them to a certain degree. But I know I'm struggling here. And I need you guys. I have to have you. And I think this is going to help us to see everything in this cohesive, just like a body works. The finger, the arm, the torso, the body. Okay? So again, we're trying to be Bible here. We're not trying to be analytical. We're not trying to be theological or indoctrinating or anything like that. We're trying to be Bible here. We're trying to follow biblical patterns. Okay? All right, moving on. So we've got primed one-on-one. We've got DNA, which is creating this Calvary mentality of accountability and nurturing. Okay? That's tier two, if you want to think of it in tiers. Then you got GC. This we're more familiar with because we've had this structure in place for a while. In our opinion, not much is going to change with kind of the way GC is structured. And I kind of had some interesting thoughts that we can kind of piggyback on, Kyle, if you have something to add. But GC, we think 12 to 15 people, and even statistically, it's very interesting. Even if you go to secular studies, I used to look at them years ago, found it fascinating that even secular studies will say, even in, whether it's spiritual, in a Christian circle or non-Christian circle, anything spiritual or religious or secular, like an academic groupthink activity in college, once you reach, and it's fascinating because all these statistics average out to the same number. Do you know what number it is? 12. It's 12. I've read so many, and it's fascinating. Every once in a while, you might get like a 14, but you have all those metrics that have factors. But overwhelmingly, secular and religious statistics point to this number being key. Key for what? Intimacy. And all I mean by intimacy is the willingness for each individual component to participate. That's all we're talking about. Once you get too far beyond this number, there's something in the human instinct. Again, that's why I think Jesus was very delicate in hearing from God. How many, Lord? 12. Because what did he pray in John 17? I've called all the ones that you gave to me. He was very specific. Because God told him to be very specific. Go get 12. And then of those 12, choose 3. And then beyond that, okay? But 12 is a number that even statistics and science, you could say, will support is that number by which once you get too far beyond, you're going to be struggling. Whether that's trying to write a paper together or a group project or theater project, it just, if y'all have experienced anything like that in school, it's disastrous, is it not? Once you get, yeah, Shelby, yeah.
12 adults?
I'm sure every study's, children. I'm sure every study's different. Oh, 12, yes, we're thinking more adults here. I'm sorry. And there's going to be, guys, there's looseness to all this. So don't see numbers and freak. You know, there's going to be looseness to all this because this,
this is,
there's not going to be any rigidity that's going to rule and reign anything like this, okay? But as far as what GCs are going to be about, I was kind of thinking, you know, one thing that you see the early church doing, if you go read Acts chapter 2 and chapter 4, you kind of get these glimpses of what the people of God did at the very beginning, which doesn't necessarily mean that's exactly what we do. But they were seeing God move powerfully, were they not? They were seeing God move in wonderful ways. And there was unity, all the things that Paul was telling later churches to pursue, this unity of the Spirit. And so when you get to Acts 2 and you get to Acts 4, you see them focusing on a few things. One of them, eating. Oh, yeah. We do that great. No problems there. Moving on. They were eating together. It says they were fellowshipping around the breaking of bread and the prayers. So they were breaking bread together, symbolic of just Christ-centered fellowship around meals. We all have to know by now, whether you're a kid or an adult, something magical happens around a table with people. Nothing explains it. The mysteries of God can't be explained with human words, but something magical happens. There's this bonding, this intimacy, this unity, this fellowship that's just experienced in that unique way. They were doing that, but they were also, it says they were taking heed to the apostles' teachings. Okay, so as they're eating together and fellowshipping, I hadn't thought about this till today, they were actually hearing and heeding. I forget what the ESV says. Let me look it up really quick. Devoted, that's the word. I've seen heeding in another. They were devoted to the apostles' teaching. Yeah, it says, they, the early church, after the first 3,000 souls were added on Pentecost, says these people, these Christians, devoted themselves. Devoted. Sounds like desire, doesn't it? To the apostles' teachings, to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and the prayers. All came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were being done through them. So, what we've done in GC in the past, at least I know last year, was, you know, Kyle has taken his kind of the summation, the notes from, I guess, extended notes, questions from his previous sermon, which is essentially apostles' teaching standing for the teachings that came from Christ. So Kyle delivers those as pastor to us. He equips us on a Sunday morning, and then we come together in a fellowship like this, where we're eating together, we're praying together, and we're actually going a little deeper on the teaching. So we're thinking of kind of keeping that there's this message centered, this teaching centered element to the GC, but it's not going to be as, I guess, rigorous is the word that comes to mind, as say a DNA group get together. In other words, this might be a little bit looser, a little bit more, we might use the word ministry-oriented, which is where those like one anothering, that kind of phrases come in. Loving one another, encouraging one another. Of course, that's going to happen here too. But the GC, because it's a larger group, there's going to be things that don't need to be shared there, right? Save some things for DNA. So here, it'll be a little bit looser. A little bit more calm, 30-minute, 40-minute meal. And this is something we're probably more familiar with. But again, do you see how the tiers are changing but fueling? So our idea is, again, as primed, as we're getting primed individually, that flowing into our DNA, then you're going to have two or three DNA groups, essentially, meeting in a gospel community of 12 to 15. And now what do you have? Now you have these little, what did I say earlier, sectors? Maybe now's the time for a sector. Those were pods. Three pods. This is getting real intimate. Three pods in a sector. But do you see how the intimacy that's happening in a small group is going to affect the larger group? There's not going to be very much intimacy. I don't think it makes any sense in the real world for there to be intimacy and true growth in a, say, gospel community level of 12 to 15, maybe even a little more if we have to or whatever, if there's not health here and here first. I think it's going to be a waterfall effect. I think that's the way Jesus modeled it. I think it's the way he set his whole life up, his whole ministry up, or rather the Father set his ministry up for him. That's what Jesus walked in, this hierarchy of relationships that helped guide. And have you thought about the prioritization of Jesus? Does it not blow your mind like it does mine that there were some times that he just chose not to go to a city that was full of sick people? He could have healed them. He didn't, because in this other place is where God's telling me to go. Like, he was so sensitive. I like using that word. He was so in tune with what God was structuring for him and so obedient to that, even if it didn't accord with his emotions. You got to think the man side of him wanted to go. You got to think it wanted to go. The same reason he wept with Mary and Martha, knowing he was about to raise Lazarus from the dead. Why did he weep? He was about to raise him back to life. So why did he cry? Because he was emotional and he felt. He felt deeply. But he had structure. He had structure. He had something that was guiding his priorities. And God had put it there and said, when I want you to go over there, I'll tell you to go over there. But he knew there were guide rails, and he knew there was a mission ahead of him. Every day, I believe. I believe Jesus was a master at this, and everything else followed suit. A master. So GC, I think it's probably easy to understand how that's going to affect our corporate worship. We're going to come together in a bigger setting like this, and we're not just going to be sharing, I don't think we'll be sharing so much of stories of what just we've seen maybe throughout the week, or what we're, let me phrase it this way. Maybe we won't be talking so much about what we're struggling with as opposed to victories we're having. Because I'm going to be honest, church, I'm tired myself of telling everybody how much I'm struggling with things. I really am. I want to be talking about victories over sin. I want to be talking about sharing the gospel and seeing God be victorious over coworkers' sin and rebellion. And I'm just not having those conversations as much as I want to be. And that's on me. That's because I've not been stepping out in faith. And I believe I need some structure. And I think you do too. I think we as a whole, to have this one heart, need something like this to guide us, to give us mission, to give us help. Now, question two. Let's go ahead and do question two. So, reiterate question one was, what is that one? And if it's changed since I've been talking tonight, you can change it. Question one, yeah. You need question two. Kyle's bringing it. I'm going to reiterate question one, and then I'll preface question two. So question one, if it's changed for you, go ahead and change it. Or add to it, yeah. I really want to challenge you to, keep question one simple, though. Don't overcomplicate it. If it's you're too busy and the kids are doing this and the wife and the husband are there, don't write all that. Just say busy. God knows what it is. Don't circle anything yet, guys. I'm going to be honest, I think this question is more important than question one. Yeah, I didn't identify the scale, did I? It's the Richter scale.
You're really, really, really willing. You're at
Okay, don't circle anything. Don't circle anything, because I want to be very clear about what I intend behind this question, what I think God intends behind it. I think this one's probably more important than question one, mainly because God knows the answer to question one. You don't even have to know the answer to question one. God knows your heart. If you are caught up in an addiction of any sort, if you are loving TV more than God, He knows that. You don't have to write that on a piece of paper for that to be known to God. But this question is getting at your heart and your heart's willingness to get over that so that you can get to God. He does. But here's where I want you to be extremely honest with yourself, is what I'm saying. In the other one, you could not be so honest, and God knows the honest answer. Here, I think there's more danger in you deceiving yourself. Because we're not talking about more activities. When I say willingness, when I say on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the lowest willingness, 10 being the highest willingness, when I say identify how willing you are at this moment to making any changes necessary in order to see God's glory manifested in your life, we're talking about in the same way David did. He looked at God all the time. He sang to God all the time. He meditated on God's perfections all the time. We're not talking there about cooking meals, more meals. We're not talking about serving here or there or doing this or that activity. We're talking about the heart. So if you're really willing to have this dissection of your heart, because all this, Kyle mentioned this, oh, this was brilliant. This is going to be burdensome, guys, if you don't really want to see God's glory. If you want more activity because you think that'll please God or make you feel better, then this may make you feel good for a while following a structure like this, but over time, the works themselves will make you run drier than you were when you started. So make sure you understand what the willingness is getting at, okay? So go ahead and circle on the scale. What you think your willingness is to change whatever you think you need to for your heart to truly love God. No cheating. Don't look at her paper. This will be the last thing. I want you to take question two home with you. Question one, we're actually going to, what was the word you used, Kyle? Whenever you talked about wadding it up. Okay. Renounce.
I don't know.
We're gonna do as best we can to give ourselves something to hold on to, so to speak, by rip it up if you want, crumble it up if you want, if your heart feels you need to. If not, that's fine. No one's going to judge here. But question one, we're going to destroy, and you're going to throw it in the trash can on the way out to typify, if that is your heart's desire, to typify this, I'm doing everything I can to throw it away, to get rid of it, if it's not God. If your heart's not there, you don't have to. You can hang on to it and look at it all week. I hope you don't, But you can if you need to think about it. But just do what's honest to yourself, honest to the Lord. He knows. But I'm going to challenge everyone to get to that point before you leave tonight and throw question one away in the trash. Question two, hang on to it. And I want you to look at it every day throughout the week this week. And circle different numbers every day if it changes. And see what the Lord does. I want to give you one last thing, one real quick statement that God gave me on my way home from work. It hit me like a ton of bricks, guys. And the Lord usually, I haven't heard Him speak to me like this pointedly, often. But it was one of those, you know, sometimes you just hear real clearly on one thing from the Lord, and He says about 40 things in 2 seconds of real time. That's what He did in this moment. Because I was pleading with Him, saying, How do you talk about these things? Like, how do you challenge yourself? I'm talking about myself. God, what do I say to myself to get to a 10 and actually do it? And then I thought about what I do every morning. My alarm goes off at 5:30, and in fact, this will be the one thing I use the board for. So I wake up at 5:30, and here's what I do. Here's what I think happens. Kyle touched on it. My mind, my heart, and even my body goes to work. It goes to work hard. Starts building this really elaborate altar with all of these angels on the corners. Looks much like the Ark, right? Starts building this elaborate altar, okay? This wooden altar. And immediately from second one, I've got this altar built with comfort sitting on top. Comfort's up here. Who remembers where God would meet with them in the tabernacle? Wasn't it above the mercy seat? My heart, my mind, my body goes to work, and it works hard, very fast, in those first few seconds of the day to create this comfort as God. And when I ask the Lord, and that's just where it begins. Then it becomes food, because I'm hungry. Then it becomes entertainment. Then it becomes work, because I'm too busy. Then everything hits me. I've got all these gods. I've got all these altars that my mind has built within the first 60 minutes of the day. And so I'm asking God, like, what is going on here? And it was one of those tiny little snippets of time where God said a whole bunch, but this is a summation of it. He said, all my kids have to do is stop offering me as a sacrifice on their altar of desires. So just like the people of old would offer a lamb, you know, on an altar as sacrifice for God, you know, this whole concept of worshiping God by giving something up in sacrifice, it's God I'm sacrificing. For who? Another God. Sounds like Solomon's life, doesn't it? Second one of every day, I think the spiritual war begins. And whatever we fed ourselves with the day before is probably what's going to immediately try to take over. Whether that's more sleep, or just general comfort, or the heat of the bed, or the anxieties of the day, whatever it is, we're going to try to create something in our sinfulness that God is going to have to say, no, remember, I'm up there. You sacrifice that. We have to reverse it. So let that be the challenge. That is my challenge and my prayer. In fact, let's just go ahead. God, do you have anything before I'm just going to pray? Yeah. Close. Okay. Yeah, I'll pray to dismiss. That's okay.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this message. If you would like more information about Journey Baptist Church, please visit our website at journeybaptist.com.